October 21st, 2024, from Peachfish Productions, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. And my money's on Kamala Harris. Oh, I don't think she'll win. I don't think she'll lose. I just like the odds that I'm getting on Polymarkets, where she is down to a 39% chance of winning. I actually think it is a coin flip. I'm assessing those odds. 39% is just too low. Run this election 10,000 times, and I come out ahead. Fortunately, we only have to live with the one time. But I look at the odds. If I bet 100, I win $158. If I bet 100 on Trump, I only profit $64. So why are the odds so low? There's been reporting in the Wall Street Journal that the market, Polymarket, has been manipulated by pro-Trump forces to make Trump seem more likely to win. Well, why would it be important for Trump to seem more likely to win by people who want to elect Trump? Well, it is well known in elections that the candidate seen as more likely to win more often does win. Less well known is if that's because that candidate was actually likely to win. Still, everyone who campaigns for a candidate always says, my candidate's going to win. Here is Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro on This Week, This Week.
If the election were held today, who would win?
I think Kamala Harris wins. But make no mistake, it's close.
Of course he and the other two governors who were interviewed are going to say that. But why? Isn't it, when you think about it, just as likely to work on a person psychologically for that person to answer, actually, I'm worried that she's going to lose? Democracy is on the line. We always say that. I believe that. And right now, I think we're going to lose American democracy. Wouldn't that be a great motivator to a lot of people? Do this or we'll lose. No, it would not be a great motivator. You got to say, it'll be us, but only if. You can't say, it won't be us, unless. It's all stupid stuff, right? Or perhaps it's human stuff. I am the kind of human who sees democracy on the line and says, ooh, Polymarket's offering slightly favorable expected value. Much better than the Cardinals-Chargers game this evening. Oh, one more thing. Given that this is the case, and it is the case, that it's beneficial for a candidate to have optimism around their campaign for the regular, non-decided voter to think that's the campaign that's going to win, which of the two candidates in this coin flip election do you think is benefiting from that phenomenon? Before I could even end the sentence, you said to yourself, the Republicans, right? The Republicans have more of their backers confident that their guy is going to win. The Democrats are very, very worried. And the Republicans are acting like, nope, we got this. Now, maybe you said that's true, but maybe you also said, yeah, but that's for good reason. It's because the Republicans are glib or unrealistic, or because Republicans don't have as much at stake and we Democrats will have to suffer much more, or some other reason to explain why the pessimistic side of a coin flip is the correct side. But that's my point. There is no correct side. It's 50-50. So pessimism or optimism doesn't actually make sense. And pessimism is harmful to the pessimistic side. If this were, say, exactly a 50-50 country, and after everything else was priced in, the only determinant of who wins the election would be this really weird psychological tendency of the pessimists to lose, well, if that were the case, the Democrats would lose. Kamala Harris would lose. I'd be out my bet on Polymarkets. So congratulations, Party of Miserableism. You crafted a circumstance which assures that your pessimism is rewarded and vindicated. Downside, Donald Trump gets to be president again. Anyway, I am hoping that scenario is not the case, which explains my bet on Harris. It's not because of hope. It's the belief that the Trump hope is a manufactured fake hope, thus offering me a buying opportunity, which is, of course, the greatest hope of all. On the show today, Palmer, presidents, penises, all in the spiel. But first, if you're a longtime listener to The Gist, you'll likely know that I'm a collector of disc jockeys and radio personalities. I enjoyed Wolfman Jack and a guy named Ira Fistel and, of course, Mike and his erstwhile companion, the Mad Dog. In Chicago, great sports talk personality was Harry Tynowitz. He hosted on ESPN Radio. He's a comedian. He's an actor. And He's an alcoholic. He will tell you that. He is now a playwright. His play, Another Shot, chronicles his journey. And playing the role of Harry is Dan Butler, who played Bulldog Briscoe on Frasier for many years. Harry Tynowitz and Dan Butler up next. For 25 years, Harry Tynowitz was a radio host, a sports talk radio host. You're going to meet him in a second and say, yeah, that fits. And then he got a DUI. He went into rehab and eventually, I don't want to ruin the ending, but he is here with us because he got a new liver. He has written a show about his experience. It was originally mounted in Chicago called, this is pretty funny, When Harry Met Rehab. Now it's called Another Shot, which as far as I could tell works on three levels, right? The sports, the drinking, and another chance at life. Playing Harry in this show is Dan Butler, who I think you know. He played Bulldog, another sports talk radio host, on Frasier for about a decade, and has been in so many productions and so many movies, and they both join me now. Harry, Dan, welcome to The Gist.
Thank you so much.
Mike, it is an honor to be with a man as accomplished as you and as Dan. And Joel, your producer, I'm a little concerned about.
Yes. Giving away, yes, just like Brecht giving away some of the apparatus of the performance. So, Dan, I do want to ask you, when you saw this script and you said, oh, a sports talk radio guy, I know that. Was it an inducement or was it, did it give you pause to play that character that maybe to most people you're so well known for?
No, in fact, I didn't really think about that aspect of it. I mean, I was taken in more by the rehab recovery section. And we first did it. It was during the pandemic. We did it as a read over Zoom. And what I still love about the piece is either playing it or watching it, experiencing it. I think it starts out and you think you've got it pegged, like it's going to, oh, this is what this experience is going to be like. And then it changes and it surprises you. And I mean, that's what makes a great theater experience.
Because it gets more vulnerable and your character gets more vulnerable as the play goes on, as rehab goes on. And that must have been what your journey was like, Harry, and essential to your journey in rehab.
It was not, I knew I was going into rehab about 21 hours before I went into rehab. Mm-hmm. And everybody else there, I knew they were coming in for weeks or a month. A lot of doctors there, a lot of doctors from Kansas City there. Guys, if you're ever in Kansas City and you have a medical ailment, don't stop driving till you hit Wichita. But the reason why the show is like it is, Mike, is Dan Butler. He has transformed the role. We were talking about who we could possibly get. And they said, well, let's just do the read through on Zoom and we'll worry about it. And they go, Dan Butler is going to play you for the read through. I said, we have access to Dan Butler and we haven't asked him. Mm-hmm. And then it was just a matter of time. And he's taken what was a guy who was not sure of himself and what he had to do and turned him into a messenger for, if you don't know anyone who's an alcoholic or has an addiction issue, you're going to still love the play. It's a fun night of theater. It's a great night of theater. It's a very funny show, I think. And it's got a lot of serious moments. But Dan has taken this role and this play and put it on his back, and it is just wonderful to watch.
Dan, do you want to, I assume you've played people that you've met before. Do you want to model your performance on them or not? Some actors just don't want to know that, find their own character there.
You know, what I love about anything I'm doing, I love all those mysterious compellings that inform it, you know, and also, what I love is coming back to this after having done it 3 years ago and going, oh, I was a different person then. And what moves me and what may be funny or moving, or it's different now. And you sort of have to let go of what Chicago was, and, you know, what is it now? And, you know, yes, there are some, I'm glad that Harry mentioned, it's a very entertaining, fun ride. And like I said, that surprising quality is something I always love about theater. But there have been some, friends that have passed away recently, and those people come, that person and others in my life, you know, I just, I had them around, and, you know, just their name, inform, you know, you just turn it over and I'm thinking about you. So
when you meet Harry, do you want to take some of the gravel in his voice, some of the causticity, if I could use that, in his manner? Because the lines are written on the page, so you know he has quips and you know the character is sarcastic. But there are different ways to play sarcastic, right? The arch way, or let us say the gruff but lovable mode that I find Harry to be in. So the real Harry, how much does that affect your choices?
Well, it was great meeting Harry. Then it's sort of a alchemical process where there's a bit of this, there's a bit of that, and then I let it go. And I'm not, you know, I'm not trying to do an impersonation. It's where do Harry and I meet? And it was I wasn't trying to do an imitation, but it was wonderful when we were doing playing Chicago, and I met his daughter after a performance, and she was going, oh, you were just like, and I'm just like my dad or something. So that's not, I wasn't trying to do that.
What was, Harry, what was the main thing that you wanted the audience to take away from your or the rehab experience? Because there's a lot of fun. There's your story, and we'll get to that in a second. But there's also, you know, there's been a lot of media about rehab and what might take place as at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting or rehab. But what was the new thing that you wanted to emphasize for them?
I wanted to make this the truest telling of what actually happens in rehab. There's a line in the show, and it's accurate. I showed up at rehab not realizing that I was done drinking. If I had known that, I would have never gone. Mm-hmm. You know, I thought they were going to teach me how to drink like a gentleman, like, you know, martini, shaken, not stirred, instead of four Cuervos. And I wanted this to be just gritty and real. And the best compliment I can get is when someone who's in the program or who's dealt with someone that has, you know, an addiction, when they say, boy, that was about as real as I've ever seen. And again, it's a tribute to the six actors, to Jackson Gay, our great director. And I mean, our producer went to an open AA meeting to learn about what happens in these meetings.
Huh.
You know, and Dan, when I was here, Dan would say, can you come down tomorrow? Can we talk about your mom? Because at one point my mom was in the show. At one point, Dan had a line where he's talking like his mom. And he just meticulous with his, he's like, you know, he's like an inspector with the police investigating the role. But I wanted this play to be gritty.
You were a well-known radio personality in Chicago, and then you're on the evening news and in the front pages having a DUI. Is that, well, maybe not the front pages, but somewhere stuck inside the pages.
I led the 5 o'clock news one day. I mean,
wow.
How pathetic is that? An out of shape sports radio guy whose greatest, you know, athletic accomplishment was being in the winner's circle when a certain horse won a certain race. And now I'm, you know, five out of 6 days I was in the paper. There was nothing else happening in the world.
So your job was on the line, your livelihood, your reputation. You not must have felt you were professionally forced into rehab. That's not a good way for it to stick, is it?
It's not. There were 20 people when I got there. There were 20 people when I left. So I'm estimating in the 56 days I was there, 55 days I was there, that I knew, you know, 40 people. And I was the only person there that found out He was going in a day beforehand, but with one exception, everybody is in the same spot. They are forced to be there. There was one guy who on his own just chose to be there because he knew the disease can kill, but everybody else, we were forced to be there. And, you know, ESPN made me release a public statement saying I was taking this anonymous program seriously. And I said, that defeats my anonymity. You know, this program works because people can be anonymous. And they go, just put the statement out.
Yeah.
Here's what I've learned since I got sober is take responsibility. And, you know, that the next morning I was like, oh, I didn't deserve to get pulled over. I'm going to beat this in court. And then I realized I'm an idiot. I'm a moron. You know, why am I driving when I'm legally over the limit?
It also strikes me that many of the skills, the virtues that you were paid for and prized for as being a broadcaster were things that would get in the way of complicate your recovery. Like you were glib. You could make a joke about things. You didn't take things too seriously. You were not terribly introspective. You blamed others. Like this is what we want our sports radio guys to do, to blame the coach, to blame the receiver, to kind of channel our blame. I don't know. Is that a fair enough point? Did you feel that your personality traits prized in one arena were damning you in another?
Yeah, no, I'd say that's accurate because they presented me as Mr. Party. And so the night I got my DUI, I'm at the Hawks game. I had put my drink down at the start of the third period. And we went into the bar to let the traffic pass. And next thing I know, I'm doing four double shots. And, I regret. You know, one of the things in my program is no regrets, which I think is the stupidest thing.
Uh-huh.
Love my program. 2 million people are currently in it. It has saved so many lives, and it will save so many more lives. But there are so many things I disagree with, including don't have any regrets.
Mm-hmm.
It's not practical. And what I hope happens in this play is people just go and they love this play for 94 minutes. And then, by the way, 94 minutes, you're welcome. And if you don't know anybody, and I think most people know someone, they're just not aware of it. Could be a neighbor, could be a teacher, could be somebody else at work. But if you go see this show, you can understand maybe, you know, from a different perspective of what people like me go through.
Dan, I know that every time an actor approaches a role, if he or she is a good actor, you have a responsibility to the text. But in a performance like this, just because you're alive in 2024 and you've lived a life, you must know people in recovery. You must know maybe people in the program, as they say. I don't know anything about your own life. But is there a heightened or extra responsibility? Maybe during the process you checked in, I don't know if you did, with others who are going through or went through a similar thing. Did that go on?
Well, yes. And what I think is wonderful about being in a play like this, you know, it's great to have a wonderful role in a wonderful play. But when you are part of something which is about modeling behavior learned, you know, through a crucible, and to help people. I mean, I think, yes, it's wonderful to talk to the recovery community, but I think the play is universal about, I mean, we're all recovering from something. We all make something else our higher power. We've all been infatuated with a person, a place, a thing, an object, you know, whatever. And to model helping each other, to model community, to model telling the truth, to model these things, which it's sad, but you need them modeled or they go away.
Tell me, this is the indulgent question that I'm sure you're not going to like, but Bulldog and Harry are both sports radio jocks. How are they different? I know you don't really, you did many, many, many scenes as Bulldog. You have a little bit where we get to see maybe what Harry was like on the air. If you had to contrast them, how would they be? What different types of sports talk radio jocks would they be?
It's funny because I go,
You know, I was just doing a show in Ireland and they would interview me a lot about Bulldog because it's a very popular show over there. Multi-generational because of the pandemic and people watching it again. When they talked about it, I said, you know, what intrigues me, because they were saying, well, do you want to go back into the new show? Or I said, well, I never expected it because he's going to a new place. But what did intrigue me, I go, I wonder how the character dealt with the Me Too movement. I wonder if he had a midlife 180 degree turn. That intrigued me. So again, it's not a direct answer to your, but I don't know, especially with an older Bulldog, more my age and Harry's age now, whether they would be similar, not similar, or you're just waiting for some change to happen, which may have been long overdue. So that intrigues me.
Yeah. What do you think? What's your answer to that question, having seen both, Harry?
Well, I think you have to realize how horny both Bulldog and Harry really were when they were on the radio. And Dan, by the way, is, of course, going to be in the reboot. He's in the new version of Frasier coming up. And I asked him about it. One of the first things I asked him about is, you know, sports radio guy. You cool with that? And he's like, but that's just what you did. You know, there's so much more to you. And like actors. So I was an actor my whole life and now I'm a writer. And, you know, I've been taught by several people to say fucking actor. But that's not right. But I'm just saying what I love about actors is what I love about Dan. So I did stand up for 7 years. Dan decides one night to go to Zany's, the big comedy club in downtown Chicago. You know, Seinfeld started there. George Carlin, Pryor. You know, it's just it's a who's who of stand-ups, and the walls are covered with these pictures. Richard Lewis and Dan went there one night because he wanted to try to envision what it must have been like for me, you know, when I was doing the radio to keep doing stand-up once in a while, and he wanted to like imagine what it would be like for me and how would it be that I was drinking. But I didn't drink on the radio, but comedy club. I mean, you're in a bar, you work in a bar every night, and it's. You know, it's hard to not drink. And, you know, you could have a couple and it would not affect your show. But I admire the fact as to how far out there he put himself. So, I mean, he even if he's not giving you the answer you want right now, he knows in his head the differences.
The name of the play is Another Shot. It's in previews through October 29th at the Romulus Linney Courtyard Theater at the Pershing Square Signature Theater. That's it. We're out of time for the interview. Just naming the name of the theater took that long. It was written by Harry Tynowitz along with Spike Manton. It stars Dan Butler. And as you perhaps got a glimpse, the people behind the show are extremely interesting. You may want to spend your time with them. Harry, Dan, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mike. You were a delight.
Hey, baby, I hear the blues are calling. Tossed salads and scrambled eggs. Mercy. And maybe I seem a bit confused. Yeah, maybe. But I got you pegged. But I don't know what to do with those tossed salads and scrambled eggs. They're calling again. Scrambled eggs all over my face. What is a boy to do? Good night, Seattle, we love you!
And now the spiel. Arnold Palmer won 7 majors, including the Masters 4 times, was one of the top golfers ever. If there was a Mount Rushmore for golf, he would be on it. And with all of that, with all of those accomplishments, everything he did for the game, he is known for pouring a lemonade into an iced tea. Dom Perignon, Shirley Temple, Arnold Palmer, drinks name for people. I always thought that was very curious about his legacy, that is how the name lives on to my kids who barely knew he was a golfer. If there was a Mount Rushmore for mocktails, he would be on it. Well, maybe it would be a combined Mount Rushmore and Christ the Redeemer, 2 parts Rushmore, 1 part Jesus, in keeping with the Arnold Palmer. But now, Arnold Palmer's legacy is no longer a beverage. Unfortunately for Arnold Palmer and the Palmer Estate, it's not golf either. But we also have to say it's not exactly what you think I'm going to say. You know, his wang doodle. No, it's a little more subtle than that. It is the fact that this famous golfer 7-iron has become a driving issue in the presidential race.
But when he took showers with the other pros, they came out of there, they said, oh my God, that's unbelievable. I had to say it.
Look, every golf enthusiast knows you have to pay special attention to your putts. And I say that's all Donald Trump was doing. You thought a lemonade/iced tea was refreshing? How about a presidential candidate as refreshingly unpretentious as Donald Trump? Only some people didn't see it this way. Philip Gurevich, Pulitzer Prize-winning New Yorker writer, tweeted, "Disinhibition is a common feature of dementia. Alarming to contemplate, since Trump has always been gross and degraded, but he is getting grosser and more befouled in degradation." Oh, see, I somehow had the impression that he was an uncouth vulgarian from way back. No, apparently, he's finding new lows, so says National Review's Ramesh Panuru.
If you compare the way he speaks to the way he spoke in 2016, let alone to the way he spoke in clips from the 1980s, it's not the same person.
Except it's the exact same person. Donald Trump, newly demented? Here was Donald Trump in 2007.
If Ivanka weren't my daughter, perhaps I'd be dating her. You know?
Stop it! Oh, it's so weird. Stop it.
You know what? You are sick.
Isn't that terrible?
Yeah.
Well,
you're known for saying outrageous things.
Hear the ladies from The View giggling, noting, you're known for saying outrageous things. Indeed, he has been at this forever. Here he was in 1998 on The Howard Stern Show, talking about all the women that Donald Trump, in Howard's words, not mine, banged.
Like, you say to him, look, you got to go take a medical test before I'll do you?
Well, you'd like to say that, and sometimes you do. The problem is that sometimes your own chemicals take over, and you can't wait.
Yeah. So what were you, so you'll just have straight intercourse with a rubber with them, right?
Well, I don't know. You know, there's lots of different ways of doing it, I guess. But,
I mean, if anything, Trump was more inhibited in referring to Palmer's manhood than his forays into his own unprotected sex. But who cares? This trend of looking at this old established pattern and seeing new information, it's clearly dementia, a dementia we've never seen before. It's probably kind of well-intentioned. I don't think that these members of the media are just lying to you or exaggerating or telling you something they don't believe. Gurevich definitely does not want Trump to be president. So what did someone like him do? You say, can you believe the guy? You think about a way to contextualize the latest outrage. You say, I can't fathom it. Yeah, you should be able to. If you've been paying attention all along, this is clearly of a piece with who the man is. You could also say something like, and we're hearing this, it's worse than ever before. I disagree. I think it's just as bad. But when you say, that's just as bad, it lacks some of the urgency as, I can't believe this guy's going to be president. You know what? He once was. Wasn't that good? And of course, you should be appalled. Everyone who hears this should be appalled. As we were all appalled when he made penis references 8.5 years ago, this wasn't an unknown topic for him. Remember this clip? I'll play the clip from the debate, and then immediately you'll hear coverage of the popular liberal YouTuber David Pakman.
He hit my hands. Nobody has ever hit my hands. I've never heard of this one. Look at those hands. Are they small hands? And he referred to my hands. If they're small, something else must be small. I guarantee you there's no problem. I guarantee.
Okay. Moving on.
You say that you are the true...
Lewis, you know how sometimes we say things are basically like a penis size contest, but it's an analogy? The Republican primary is now literally a penis size contest. Penis size is being discussed at debates.
It is. I can't believe that this is the state of political discourse in the United States right now.
He's not sinking to a new low, people. He's been wallowing. Why do we have to spin it into something new, different, newly dangerous? I guess if you say, oh, this is the guy he's always been, you seemingly take away the need to get to the polls and vote against him. I do, however, think the sputtering, incomprehending, it's a new low, I think all that talk, discredits the sputterer. The right analysis is, yes, he is Donald Trump. This is what he does. And the policies he backs will make life worse for more Americans than his opponent's policies. I do believe that. I firmly believe that. I have not gone soft on the real issues. And yes, if you think I said the last sentence as a subliminal penis reference, maybe you're the one with the problem seeing or hearing penises everywhere. Obelisks, missiles, Greek statues tumbling from the mouth of Republican presidential candidates. Okay, I'll admit it. That was all a bit sophomoric on my part. But that's my point. I'd have made that joke as a sophomore in high school, and I make that joke today. I am trying to prove that I am not increasingly disinhibited. And you know what? Trump isn't either. He's a bit dimmer. It happens when you hit your late 70s. Wasn't too bright to begin with. And if we were to open a hatch and be able to peer into the Trump brain, what we see would be pretty consistent through the ages. The very small areas of that brain, not dedicated to Donald Trump himself, would be a collection of grievances and opinions about women's bodies and stray thoughts about Hannibal Lecter, his Uncle John, Al Capone, nothing definitely about Tiffany. And they are getting dusty in the corner. It's the Michigan Man of the Year Award. Oh, over there, around the bend. It's a big guy at a rally crying and saying, thank you, Mr. Trump. And there, at the bar, it's Arnold Palmer. Look, he's mixing a drink. A lemonade and an iced tea, but oh my God, what is he using as a swizzle stick? And that's it for today's show. The Gist was produced by Corey Wara. The Gist senior producer is Joel Patterson. Leo Baum interns. Michelle Pesca is the CBSO of Peachfish Productions. To advertise, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Thank you. Thank you for listening.